Well, it used to be considered self-evident, the relationship, whatever that relationship might be, between marriage and procreation, between a husband and a wife entering into what they used to call the bond of marriage, and, if possible, having children, perpetuating the species, maybe even more than simply perpetuating the species. We're going to be talking about that relationship between marriage and procreation. Where did it go? How is it that Massachusetts, one of the first and states not only to recognize that self-evident truth, but one of the first states also to deny that self-evident truth by permitting gay marriage, how did they get to the point of saying it's not so obvious that marriage and procreation go together, and maybe they really don't at all? We're going to answer that question here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. Dr. Alan Carlson joins us here in just a moment. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're coming to you live this Tuesday. It is already the 19th of September. A little brisk outside, and that means fall is literally in the air, if not on the calendar. In the first half hour, it's marriage and procreation. Then, in the second half hour, Jimmy Carter, former president of the United States, has written a book called Endangered Values. Mark Tooley of the Institute on Religion and Democracy is going to join us to give us a review of Jimmy Carter's new book. And then, starting up at 4 o'clock, a short interview. This is a sad occasion on this day. A short interview with Pastor David Peterson, a regular guest on this program, one of my favorite guests, and I must say one of my favorite writers, because most of my acquaintance with Dr. Kurt Marquardt was through his writing, although we had a number of occasions to meet and to talk on this program. He was called home to his eternal rest, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the life and death of this great Lutheran theologian. I am convinced history will remember him as a great American Lutheran theologian, Dr. Kurt Marquardt. And Pastor David Peterson, will join us here for a short conversation in the second hour of Issues Etc. In that vein, I think we're going to try and put together for Thursday's program today a retrospective through Issues Etc. interviews on Kurt Marquardt. Then from 4:20 on, we've got audio open lines for your questions and your comments. A lot of things to cover. There's a story from National Public Radio on an Episcopal church that is being threatened with the loss of its tax-exempt status because of a sermon that was preached there. Not the religious right in this case, but the religious left. President Bush made some remarks today as he addressed the General Assembly of the UN about whether or not we are at war with Islam. And we have two CBS reports on the continuing fallout from the Pope's comments about Islam. And finally, during audio open lines for the second half of today's program, a Today Show feature on a Baptist pastor who gives lectures and seminars in churches on what he calls hot Christian sex. We'll play a little bit of an interview, an online interview with this pastor, and then I want to know from you, has this crossed the line? I know that churches are all supposed to be about full service. They'll change your oil while you listen to the sermon. If you don't want to listen to the sermon, you can retire to their gymnasium and play a round of horse with the kids. They don't care. All about full service. Is this crossing the line? Should Christians expect the church to school them in matters not only of sexual ethics and sexual morals, and like we're doing here in the first half hour, the relationship between procreation and marriage, but also on how to have hot Christian sex? If you're a Christian, should you expect sex to be better? We'll talk about that during audio open lines, Issues Etc., coming up here in about 90 minutes on the program. Dr. Alan Carlson is a regular guest on the program. He's president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, based in Rockford, Illinois. He's authored several books, including his latest called Fractured Generations, Crafting a Family Policy for 21st Century America. And he's authored an article in the latest issue of Touchstone magazine titled The End of Marriage, Sex, Procreation, and the Gnostic Triumph. Dr. Carlson, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Pleased to be with you.
Well, I mentioned before that the relationship between marriage and procreation was at one time, not so long ago, considered self-evident. What exactly was that truth, that relationship between marriage and procreation?
Well, I would call it in the article, sort of the foundation of our unwritten sexual constitution for our Western Christian civilization. It arose about almost 2,000 years ago when the Church Fathers, those who put together the Christian Church, faced two challenges. First of all, they were in the middle of a Roman Empire that was quickly descending into sexual anarchy. Homosexuality was widespread, promiscuity and divorce, and adultery, all sort of considered fashionable and chic. Infanticide was still a common practice, particularly of girls. Maybe it sounds kind of familiar, but it was a difficult time. They also faced a challenge internally. The young church faced a challenge from the so-called Gnostics, a group who believed that they were above the law, that they had a secret wisdom and a secret knowledge. And then when Christ and Paul proclaimed freedom from the law, they thought that meant freedom from all law, a readiness to do whatever they wanted. And they, above all, the Gnostics, opposed procreation. Some believed in unlimited sexuality, but they always wanted it to be sterile. They didn't want children. Others committed themselves to a complete abstinence, but again, the same effect was no children. So our sexual constitution, as shaped by the early church founders, was to affirm that, in fact, sexuality found its purpose, its natural purpose, in the marriage and in procreation.
This, what you call this sexual, unwritten sexual constitution, was actually at issue not too long ago in the state of Massachusetts before the Supreme Judicial Court, if not by that name, at least in its content. Tell us about the arguments that were made there in advance of that court's decision to legalize gay marriage in that state. How did the arguments for an unwritten sexual constitution and the connection between procreation and marriage fare there?
Well, actually, at the beginning, it fared quite well. The state of Massachusetts defended its marriage law, which was limited, of course, to a man and a woman. And it defended it by saying that, indeed, the major purpose of marriage was procreation. And the original trial court affirmed that. It was only on appeal to the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, the Supreme Judicial Court, that overturned that on a 4-3 decision. And the argument they made, I mean, actually, to be in truth, they had some. There were some arguments they were able to point to say that's not true anymore. One argument was that the state of Massachusetts already allowed same-sex couples to adopt children. This was an innovation of half a dozen years ago, and that they said, well, if the state of Massachusetts allows that, how can they logically deny that couple and the child placed with that couple the benefits of stability that come from marriage? They also had a point to make that, going back to the Griswold decisions back in 1965, which struck down Supreme Court struck down laws prohibiting the sale and use of contraceptives, and also the abortion decision, Roe v. Wade, in 1973. They were able to appeal to the same logic there in saying that there's zones of liberty that have formed around the Constitution, penumbras of liberty that the state can no longer protect, and those penumbras of liberty include basically unlimited sexual experimentation under its most recent decision in Lawrence. So. What I've argued in the piece is that this appeal to the penumbras that create the so-called rights to privacy, in fact, is exactly the kind of language that the Gnostics were using 1,800 years ago in challenging the Christian church.
So why, both theologically, because this is a battle that's taking place not only in the courts of states like Massachusetts, but taking place in the higher echelons of many a mainline Protestant denomination here in the United States, why the theological and the civil abandonment of this truth and this relationship between marriage and procreation that used to be self-evident in both realms?
Well, as I say in the piece, we're facing a very new enemy here, but on the other hand, it's one as old as time. The Gnostic heresy is with us again. It's in new guise. Now, for example, I mean, the best-selling book in human history, other than the Bible, I think, still, is the Da Vinci Code. It's an openly Gnostic text. It makes no secret that it's promoting Gnosticism in 21st century guise. These new so-called Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, and most recently the Gospel of Judas, about which so much fuss was made about. Again, these are old Gnostic books, heretical distortions of the true Gospel story. But the celebration that they've been accorded and received, it's somehow these are finally telling the truth about Christianity, again, underscores just how fragile the preservation and protection of Christian truth is. The Gnostics are back.
How did the early Christians, faced with the threat of Gnosticism, which brought not only these novel ideas about marriage and procreation, but so many other errors into the church, how did they deal with it? What was their response?
Well, you can find warnings. For example, in 1 Timothy 4, Paul writes that some will depart from the faith by giving heed to deceitful spirits and the doctrines of demons who forbid marriage. In Jude 4, we read that admission into the Christian community has been secretly gained by ungodly persons who pervert the grace of God into licentiousness. All through the epistles, we find references, again, to the Gnostic threat in the early church. What the church fathers did was they had to craft a theology that grounded sexuality in the act of procreation and of rearing of children. And one of the great expressions of this was with Augustine in the year 400, where he talked about in his treatise on marriage and the goods of marriage, and he focused on on the restriction of sexuality to marriage and on the good of procreation, because it was here being modified and controlled. Sex was being modified and controlled and brought to what he called its natural use. And so they were crafting a theology that stood our civilization in very good stead. They also accepted that it was only going to be one man and one woman. Most cultures in human history have allowed some levels of polygamy. Again, the early Christian fathers said no, one man, one woman, for life, focused on procreation and rearing children. That's what marriage is about. That is our Western Christian civilization's constitution regarding sexuality.
So if we're going to follow the early Christians' lead on when they're faced with a threat to the self-evident relationship between marriage and procreation, I imagine you would say before we ask and answer the question, what is marriage, we really need, following their lead, to ask, what is marriage for?
Precisely. And I think we've lost sight. I mean, the last four or five decades have not... Christian churches didn't do a very good job in answering that. Let me give you another example having nothing to do with same-sex marriage. When we had the rise of the no-fault divorce movement, 1960s and 1970s, there were very few words of protest, certainly not from the Christian churches, and very little was said. It just was quickly approved, and it's proven to be a real tragedy for the children involved and for the adults that are involved. Easy divorce undoes part of our sexual constitution again. Similar things have happened as we've allowed, and in fact at this point the law almost encourages procreation outside of marriage and procreate and living together in procreation outside of marriage. We've eliminated many of the legal distinctions between birth in and out of wedlock. Now, some would say, well, there's good reasons for that, but the bottom line is that what it has done is that it's a growing proportion of children are being born outside of families where the father's present. And again, this is a logical consequence of things we've done. So we have been, for 40, 50 years, have watched our sexual constitution of our civilization being slowly dismantled by some very real enemies, and we've done very, very little to protest it until this last, sort of the last straw. We finally are getting our voice on the same-sex marriage issue, but if that's all we do, it won't be enough.
Very briefly, would we necessarily even be dealing with the same-sex issue at this point had we not dropped the ball on those previous issues?
I think it would not be an issue at all, not at all. I think that's exactly right. We're getting into this battle it's sort of like a football team, which we were on defense, and we paid no attention to stop the other team for the first 95 yards. And now it's first and goal on our 5-yard line, and we've got our finally mustering a defense. That's sort of where we are right now.
That's a very graphic picture illustration. I think you're right. Dr. Alan Carlson is our guest. We're talking about marriage and procreation. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. Issues Etc. is coming to you live this Tuesday, September the 19th. On the phone, calling from his car, Joe, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi. I've been pondering this, where Paul says in Corinthians that we do not belong to ourselves, and I think that the church, I mean, maybe it's been said and I just haven't been able to hear it, but that I really believe that our sexuality belongs to God, and in marriage he gives it to our spouse, that it never, I think the misunderstanding is that it never did belong to us. And again, Paul says how it's immorality is the only thing that is against our own body, that I think the sexuality is such a, it's so close to our spirituality that in the damage that happens, and again, I'd go to the guest analogy of we're against a very real enemy, and the destruction that he brings through violations of our sexuality are immeasurable.
Joe, thank you for the call. Your thoughts on Joe's comment, Dr. Carlson?
Well, I think he's right, and I think it reminds me of actually some Martin Luther's writings on these very questions, which were very profound and very deep and very relevant to our time, where he commented in his treatise on marriage, we may be assured that man and woman should and must come together in order to multiply, and that this was not a matter of free choice, but what he called a natural and necessary thing. God intended us to be procreative beings, and his theology of marriage and a family revolved and rested on that tight bond between marriage and procreation.
How would you respond to someone who, and we've talked about this many times in the program, had people raise this, what about infertile couples? What about in cases of sterility, either by natural causes or by age? Someone says, look, if I'm going to take you logically, Dr. Carlson, and if the purpose of marriage is procreation, those who can't procreate, whether or not they're heterosexual couples, shouldn't be permitted to marry.
Well, the purpose of behind Christian marriage was actually twofold, was to bear children, but also to rear them, and to rear them in a home with a mother and a father. That was implicit but strongly implied. Couples who can't have children naturally can't do the first thing, but there are opportunities for adoption where, in fact, they can fully and ably perform the second act. That's why adoption has always been a good thing. They can do it in a way that a same-sex couple can't accomplish. Again, they are in consonance and harmony with the at least part of the intent of Christian marriage, which is why it's been allowed. And even with that said, I've known dozens personally of couples who've been told they're not going to have any children. You're sterile. They adopt a child, and lo and behold, they start having children. Funny things happen in the fertility world. And I think that's why we let them marry, because we never can be entirely sure that there won't be a child.
Has the horse left the barn, at least for American society? Have we abandoned, consciously or unconsciously, so much of that self-evident truth of the relationship between procreation and marriage, that we simply do not have the tools, as you say, to defend the purpose of marriage as procreative?
Well, I think we're in a difficult spot, very difficult spot. Our ancestors have been in similar difficult spots before. It will require moral courage, a clarity of vision, intellectual and theological leadership, but renewals have happened before. Even in an American setting, we've had the first Great Awakening in the 18th century, and the second Great Awakening in the 19th century, all of which had their moral component relative to sexuality as well as other matters. So there's the Christian Church is capable of revival and renewal. But it requires, again, courage and leadership and wisdom.
What about the church within its own boundaries battling this subtle and sometimes overt Gnostic tendency, not only toward marriage, but all the other errors that Gnosticism has brought and apparently still does bring into the body of the church?
Well, you have to be constantly aware. Again, from the very beginning of time, from the Christian experience, there have been infiltrators, so to speak. Now, this doesn't mean that you have to be careful, obviously, but I think the signs of Gnosticism are pretty clear and pretty obvious. Again, a rejection of the law, of the moral law, is usually the basis for it, or saying that we have freedom from the law, we can do what we want. Christ proclaimed himself the fulfillment of the law, not the end of the law. And so the moral law, the expectations of fidelity and chastity and all the other components that go into our sexual constitution are still in place. Those have to be protected and understood very carefully. I think it even is going to require some rethinking on the whole issue of not only of abortion, where I think the Protestant churches have been coming around pretty well the last few decades, but even rethinking the contraceptive culture that we've allowed to expand and grow. I think that's going to be a real challenge for Christians in the future.
Among all these other things, with only 30 seconds to respond, Dr. Carlson, you point out in your article that the early church, even to Paul himself, sees a direct connection between the gift of marriage that God has given as an image and a picture of Christ and his church. If we lose one, that is, a proper understanding of marriage according to Scripture, are we in danger of losing that which it signifies?
Oh, I think so. And Martin Luther even has a more wonderful image, which I love, where he talks about the home based on marriage and children is, in fact, the only chance we have on earth to get a glimpse of what Eden was like. I think that's just a beautiful thought and a beautiful idea. But both have to be there for that to happen. And so we give up something very real and very rich when we let the bond go away.
Profam.org, profam.org is the website address for the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, profam.org. Dr. Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois, profam.org. He's author of several books, including his latest, Fractured Generations, Crafting a Family Policy for 21st Century America. And he's authored this article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled The End of Marriage, Sex, Procreation, and the Gnostic Triumph. Thank you very much for being our guest, Dr. Carlson.
Well, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, the second half hour of the program is straight ahead. Mark Tooley is going to join us. Former President Jimmy Carter has written a number of books, but his latest is, well, he says it's a matter of concern for him in about the last 5 years that he thinks moral dialogue in this country has taken a seriously wrong turn. He says the values that he espouses as a Christian have been hijacked, and he thinks that this present administration has gone completely wrong on the separation of church and state. His book is called Endangered Values. Mark Tooley will join us on the other side of this break for a review of Jimmy Carter's book. Stay tuned.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, etc.
Listen to the words of Martin Luther on the Lord's Prayer.
With these words, God tenderly invites us to believe that He is our true Father and that we are His true children, so that with all boldness and confidence we may ask Him as dear children ask their dear Father.
Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September is an audio CD and companion booklet called Listening to Luther. This CD contains the full teaching of Luther's Small Catechism. It covers the subjects of the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, Baptism, Confession and Absolution, and the Lord's Supper. For more information about the CD called Listening to Luther, call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 or find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Listening to Luther, at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org.
As the abortion debate heats up in South Dakota, out-of-state dollars pour in.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Where's the money coming from? Financial reports show the pro-abortion South Dakota Campaign for Healthy Families had raised $116,000 by the end of June. But among donors giving $100 or more, 37% came from outside South Dakota. Planned Parenthood, which operates the only abortion business in the state, contributed over $14,000. The group organized to support the abortion ban has raised $88,000 so far. Of their $100 givers, about 77% reside in South Dakota.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Hi, Christian here. I am so happy. I learned how to sit up without being held. You big people do that all the time, but it's hard for a baby. I was plopped, and I always toppled. Plopped on the couch, I toppled onto the cushion. Soft landing. Plopped on the floor, I toppled. Hard landing for baby's head. Daddy and Mommy chuckled every time I toppled. Come on, Christian, stay up. Hey, don't you remember when you were 17 plumpy pounds? The other day I got it. Now I get plopped, but I don't flop. I am so happy. I said, Opa, can I tell the people what I can do?
Yup, but don't brag, he said. The Bible says if you think you are standing firm, or sitting up, be careful that you don't fall.
I wonder if big people forget that some things are hard for kids. Do big people forget that they had to learn things like sitting up? Do big people forget they were teenagers and did stupid things? It might be better if they remembered they were kids.
Gotta go. Mommy just plopped me on my stomach for tummy time. Come on, Christian, lift your head up, push up your arms.
Mommy, you just wait till Opa and Oma tell me about baby Lizzie.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
Thomas Jefferson said we should build a wall between the church and state, between politics and government and religion. I believe that Christ, whom I worship, made the same kind of restraint. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, unto God the things that are God's. This administration, for the first time, has ostentatiously and openly and aggressively condoned the breaking down of that long-standing barrier between the church and the state.
Familiar voice of former President Jimmy Carter talking about his latest book called Endangered Values. We're going to be reviewing that book here during this half hour of Issues Etc. with Mark Tooley, director of the United Methodist Action for the Institute on Religion and Democracy, based in Washington, D.C. He has written an article in a recent edition of Touchstone magazine titled Eminent Betrayal, a review of Jimmy Carter's new book, Endangered Values. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Mark Tooley, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, always good to be with you.
Mark, is there anything in Jimmy Carter's new book, Endangered Values, that surprises you? What is his basic concern, and why is he writing about it now?
Well, most of the reviewers of Carter's latest book have focused on the political statements that he makes, which are pretty predictable. But in my review, I instead look at Carter's religious and theological beliefs as an ostensible evangelical, and I found what he had to say very, very interesting, even much more so than the politics of the book.
So what did you find there in terms of, the, as you say, the statements of faith?
Well, of course, Jimmy Carter almost single-handedly back in the mid-1970s helped to popularize or even to mainstream the term born again when he wrote a book by that name and discussed very openly his own spiritual born-again experience when he was running for president back in 1974, 75, and 76. And due largely to that, Carter, of course, got a majority of evangelicals, especially in the South, to support him for the presidency in 1976. However, if you look at what he has to say in his book, the positions that he comes down on, but even more revealingly, the theologians he cites as being influential on him, he really seems to have the theology more of a liberal mainline Protestant than he does that of an Orthodox or a conventional evangelical.
I want to come back to that in a second, because it is just it is odd to see this phenomenon of Jimmy Carter's made himself kind of a fixture now with this book firmly in the religious left, still adhering to a denomination that he castigates as and compares with radical Islam in his book. We recently talked with Bob Edgar. I know you know who we're talking about.
Sure.
Here, the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches, and he's got a new book out called Middle Church, and I read this book before we interviewed him, and it struck me that while he has some concerns about the religious right that I would probably agree with, he tends to overstate his case. He tends to make the same kind of overblown statements that he faults the religious right for. Is the same true of Jimmy Carter's book?
Well, in part it is, and I think a strong theme throughout Carter's book is a very vivid sense of betrayal in that he went into the presidency because of support from American evangelicals and largely was ousted from the presidency because evangelicals changed their mind and supported Ronald Reagan in 1980. And, of course, evangelicals did that because they felt that Jimmy Carter had in many ways betrayed them, that despite his professed evangelical faith, he came down on very different sides regarding issues like abortion and family structure. And evangelicals, of course, felt betrayed by that. Jimmy Carter felt betrayed both politically and religiously because he lost the presidency thanks to evangelicals voting for Ronald Reagan. But also he feels that his own church was undermined or stolen away from him when conservatives within the Southern Baptist Convention organized and took the helm of that denomination, which is America's second largest. Conservatives basically took over about 1980, at the same time Jimmy Carter was losing his political power.
I know that you focus in your review of Carter's book mostly on his theological statements and his evaluation of the religious right as it relates to the mainline church bodies that we're talking about here. But just as a matter of information, what is Carter's particular criticism of the Bush administration? Why does he think that it's a situation that's any worse in his terms than, say, to hearken back to Ronald Reagan, who played as much as he could, and as much, I think, as George W. Bush does, to the religious right of his day?
Well, Jimmy Carter, as many on the secular and religious left, attempts to directly link President Bush, especially Bush's foreign and military policies, to Bush's own personal evangelical faith, and more widely to the support that Bush has received from religious conservatives. And so their theory is that on some level, because many evangelicals believe in a particular scenario involving the end times that centers around the restoration of Israel and some kind of final apocalyptic battle in the Middle East, they therefore think that these evangelicals support an aggressive U.S. military military policy in the Middle East in some effort to set off the end times and the return of Christ. So that's the theory they're operating off of, and Jimmy Carter subscribes to that to some extent.
How does Carter evaluate mainline Protestant denominations, and he's what sort of approval, if any, does he express for the things that are going on within the mainline Protestant denominations?
Well, he doesn't address the mainline churches directly. He does speak about his own Southern Baptist Convention, from which he has somewhat separated himself, and the local church he goes to in Georgia is somewhat separated from the Southern Baptist Convention because of its conservative policies. But if you look at the theologians whom Jimmy Carter cites as being especially influential, they are theologians who were popular. They are 20th century liberal theologians who were popular in the mainline Protestant world starting in the mid-20th century. So, you know, he cites people like the Roman Catholic liberal Hans Küng or Rudolf Bultmann or Paul Tillich and Karl Barth, for example, which are people who are very influential, but they're not theologians that typically strong evangelicals will look to for their own guidance.
Is it ironic? I'm just imagining this, Mark, and tell me if I'm off base, but it seems ironic that this the first president to openly proclaim himself to be a born-again Christian. I imagine if he heard President George W. Bush talk about a born-again experience, might see it as a tip of the hat to the religious right.
Well, that is
Would he give this president the same latitude that he took when he was president, openly talking about being born again?
Well, you're exactly right in your point. And in fact, many have made the case that Bush, because of these allegations against him, that supposedly he's so close to the religious right that, in fact, Bush bends over backwards to suppress any open or a lot of open discussion about his own personal faith. And, of course, there have been studies showing that, by some measure, Bill Clinton talked more about religion than George Bush ever has done publicly. And, of course, Jimmy Carter probably exceeded both with talk about his own religious faith throughout the course of his political career.
So what's triggered this, whether it's Bob Edgar's book on the Middle Church, whether it's Jimmy Carter's book, Our Endangered Values? We just recently reported on an online effort. Democrats, Faithful Democrats, I think is what it was called, an openly religious left movement there for people of faith who don't want anything to do with the religious right. What's triggered all of this?
Well, I think there is a lot of anger on the religious left in that religious conservatives have become the dominant, certainly religious demographic in America, but seemingly they also have become the dominant political demographic in America. If you look at the exit polls from the 2004 elections, evangelicals, self-described evangelicals, made up 25% of the electorate, and that was bigger than it was bigger than any other self-identified group. And if you look at this latest study from Baylor University that just came out last week, it shows that one-third of Americans can now be described as evangelical, of course vastly exceeding mainline Protestants and outnumbering Roman Catholics. So I think that people like Bob Edgar and Jimmy Carter, who are on the liberal religious side, are obviously disturbed by that and often lash out at religious conservatives in a very exaggerated way. For example, Carter in his book equates conservatives in the Southern Baptist Convention with followers of the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. And so there's a lot of hyperbole like that.
Is this, in any sense, an attempt to reach out to and to appeal to that mainstream of evangelicals that all the pollsters see so much affecting American politics?
Well, yes and no. Ostensibly, people like Bob Edgar and Jimmy Carter want to reach out to those whom they call moderates, and Jimmy Carter would claim that his own brand of Baptist belief is moderate. But they speak of Orthodox evangelicals with such harshness, it's hard to understand how they would have much effective reach beyond liberal religious people. And, for example, Jimmy Carter, of course, has a lot of condemnation for those who feel strongly about the definition of marriage, and he accuses those who oppose same-sex marriage of being bigoted, when in fact the vast majority majority, certainly of evangelicals and the vast majority of Orthodox Christians in all traditions, would affirm that marriage should be only between a man and a woman.
Not that he really needs to, because, of course, he has served, and honorably so, as President of the United States. And apparently in his private piety seems to be a very sincere individual. But do you think that Jimmy Carter is attempting, perhaps through this book, to position himself as the moral voice or the moral face of the religious left?
Well, certainly he wants to be a force politically and religiously, and has always defined himself publicly as a religious man. And as you say, almost no one has ever questioned the sincerity of his Christian faith. But I do think that you need to understand the context of where he is coming from theologically. And while he would profess to be an evangelical, his understanding of that seems to be considerably different from the vast majority of evangelicals in America.
You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Mark Tooley is our guest. He has written a review of Jimmy Carter's newest book called Our Endangered Values, America's Moral Crisis, for Touchstone Magazine. It's called Imminent Betrayal. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'd like to hear from some of our Baptist listeners. What do you think about former President Jimmy Carter and his statements about the religious right? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Does he represent your beliefs and your concerns? Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. So, can we expect the political left to go into the next presidential cycle for 2008 ready and willing to talk about matters of faith?
Well, clearly we can. You already mentioned the new website started up by the Democratic Party for liberal Christians, and we can expect to hear more from that, and we'll continue to hear from people like Jim Wallace and others on the religious left, Bob Edgar, of course, who went to energize liberal religious people and to join together an effective coalition between the religious left and the secular left. And in some ways, that's a positive in that I don't think it's healthy for religious people or Christian people to be associated exclusively with one party. But I do think that the ideal should be for Christians of whatever political persuasion to work to change the policies of both political parties so that they more accurately reflect Christian beliefs. And we can see that conservative religious people have done that in the Republican Party, not as effectively as we might like, but the Republican Party would not have a pro-life position, for example, or would not be speaking out on marriage, for example, were it not for the strenuous beliefs of its religious supporters. But looking at the Democratic Party, the religious left, what kind of influence are they having there to ensure that Christian beliefs are expressed there? And how would the Democratic Party be any different from what it is now if religious people were to leave the Democratic Party? And it's hard to think of any firm examples of changes in policy that would take place in the Democratic Party platform if liberal religious people were to leave that party.
Does the religious left have the same potential? They seem to think that they do, to affect American policy and politics and the hearts and minds of the American people. Let's just lay aside the issue of numbers for a minute, because who can know exactly how they are numbered. But do they have the same ideological potential to be that kind of force of nature in American politics that the religious right has been?
Well, potentially they have a capacity for more influence, but I think it is somewhat constrained now because of the refusal of the religious left to in any way accommodate Orthodox positions on homosexuality and abortion. And the way they're going at it is by trying to change the subject by talking about poverty and the environment. And those certainly are legitimate issues that should be debated. But I think their main theme of those on the religious left, and Jimmy Carter certainly joins into that, and even more so Bob Edgar would, is that there really is no Christian or evangelical position regulate the economy to protect the environment. And I don't think that kind of attempted shift of topic is going to be effective among most traditional religious people.
You write this, Carter's Christian faith is no doubt deep and sincere, if not always rooted in sound theology. While he throws a lot of stones at Christians of whom he disapproves for being narrow, he has his own fairly strict test of what Jesus would do. What do you mean by that?
Well, he and others on the religious left would accuse conservative religionists of having a very narrow litmus test that must be adhered to, but obviously Carter and others have their own litmus test of issues, a card that must be punched if you are to be on the team. So while they would condemn their political and religious opponents as being fundamentalists, they are themselves equally as fundamentalists. It's just their set of fundamentals happens to be different from those of on the conservative side. And as I mentioned, of course, the environment would be on their list. Unquestioning support for an expanded welfare state would be on their list. Opposing the Bush foreign and military policy, of course, would be on their list. Some kind of same-sex union, legal recognition for same-sex couples would be on their list. So they have their litmus test, too.
Let's go to the phones briefly here as our time winds down with Mark Tooley. Al is calling from his car. Hi, Al.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I don't normally like or even call too much in on political situations, but this one to me is just so obvious. The Democrats are, well, let's go with liberals, progressive, whatever you want to choose. They take on these different projects like this to try and right themselves in a more centering position with people. And it all comes down to votes. It all comes down to money. That's what it's all about. But I don't see how they can think this is going to be a win-win situation for them, because if they swing farther to the right to pick up the conservative vote, they're going to lose those guys or gals on the left that are saying, you're gone too far right, we're going independent. They go too far to the left, they aren't going to gain any ground on the right, and they're just going to look like, you know, a bigger political fool, which I think they will in time anyway on this.
All right, Al, thank you. Thank you. Let's see what Mark has to say here. What do you make of Al's observation?
Well, he is correct. The difficulty facing the Democratic Party is it knows that to win nationally, it has to get the votes of religious people, especially in the South. But at the same time, a key part of the Democratic constituency is, of course, the feminist with strong views on abortion rights, and the gay organizations with strong opinions, obviously, about same-sex unions. So it's going to be very, very difficult for the Democratic Party to compromise on those issues in a way that will make them more palatable to traditional religious people. And that's why, as I say, they're trying to shift the debate away from those issues altogether into poverty and the environment, but I just don't think, as it's currently framed, that's going to be very effective.
Mark, before we let you go, I wanted to raise one other subject with you. You are the director of the United Methodist Action for the Institute on Religion and Democracy there in Washington, D.C. I'm going to play for you a new ad that was produced and paid for by the United Methodist Church under the banner of "When you truly embrace diversity, you embrace God." And then I'd like your reaction to this new ad from the United Methodist Church.
I believe no one who asks for help should be turned away.
I believe it's good to question.
None of us are qualified to judge the lives of others.
I believe a church isn't a building.
When you truly embrace diversity, you embrace God.
I can't believe there's a church that believes these things.
We may not all believe exactly the same thing, but the people of the United Methodist Church believe in God and each other. If you're searching for something to believe in, our hearts, our minds, and our doors are always open.
All right, there's the ad, Mark. Your reaction to it?
Well, since the Methodist Church launched this Open Hearts, Open Minds, Open Doors advertising campaign, on which it has spent, I believe, at least $10 million, maybe more than that, the church has lost about 300,000 members over the last 6 years. So that certainly is an indication of how effective these ads have been. But clearly this emphasis on PC understanding of diversity is not going to bring average people into the church. People go to church, whatever politics or theology they come from, they go to church for spiritual experience, a transformative experience, and simply repeating the mantras of diversity are not going to do that for most people.
The you know, with that kind of money spent and those numbers lost, and by the way, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, the dwindling numbers of the United Methodist Church, 300,000 isn't a small loss for them. That's a significant percentage of their total numbers there. Do you expect them to eventually at some point say, now, wait a minute, we've tried this and it hasn't worked? Or will they simply proverbially continue to beat their head against that wall?
Well, that depends on which direction the church heads in. I'm optimistic in that even though the U.S. membership is declining, the total number is growing thanks to the strong growth overseas, where, of course, they do not have these diversity advertisements going on. The church is growing overseas because people are winning individuals to Jesus Christ. So for that reason, I am hopeful for the future of Methodism, despite the inadequacies of the national church bureaucracy in the U.S.
Mark Tooley is director of the United Methodist Action for the Institute on Religion and Democracy based in Washington, D.C. He's authored an article in a recent edition of Touchstone magazine titled Eminent Betrayal. It's a review of Jimmy Carter's latest book called Endangered Values. Here's the website address for the Institute on Religion and Democracy. It's ird-renew.org, ird-renew.org. Mark, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September is one that you need not open and read. It is, in fact, one that you can simply slide into your CD player and hear. It goes nicely with the theme of radio, doesn't it? To actually listen, since you're listeners, to listen on occasion to Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month. It's called Listening to Luther. It's a narration of Luther's Small Catechism in its entirety, along with some very significant catechetical hymns, that is, hymns written by Luther that go with the themes of the catechism. It's narrated by Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. Ken Sherb. His beautiful and profundo, basso profundo voice will bring you the words of Luther. Listening to Luther is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Find it at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. You've got an hour to do so today and ask for Listening to Luther. 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Listening to Luther is our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September. When we come back from this break, it's hour two of Issues, Etc., and an entirely new subject. Pastor David Peterson joins us for a brief reflection on the life and death of Lutheran theologian Kurt Marquardt. He was a regular guest on this program many times. He joins us to talk about things like church growth and Eastern Orthodoxy and the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification and on the Gospel. He was called home to his eternal rest in the last couple of days, and we want to get a brief reflection on the life and the work and the thought of Kurt Marquardt. Pastor David Peterson will be our guest. He had the pleasure of serving as Kurt Marquardt's pastor for many years at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We'll talk with Pastor Peterson right after this.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.